Welcome to the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. Each week, Matt, Kurt, Jerry, and the occasional special guest explore how the trauma-informed paradigm challenges traditional beliefs and approaches concerning a wide variety of areas. This podcast addresses psychological trauma in an educational manner and is not designed to replace mental health treatment. If anything in this podcast makes you feel uncomfortable or anxious, please talk to a mental health professional.
Welcome, friends, to episode 19 of the Trauma Informed Lens podcast. I'm here today with Kurt. You just got us two today, so we expect to be really succinct, organized, and to the point. But we wish our friend Jerry well, as always. So, welcome. We're going to talk today about talking about trauma. One of the things that we're sort of celebrating, or Kurt is nice enough to celebrate with me, is I got my new book came in the mail today. And so it has a little strip around it because it's just going official without the strip. But Amazon was nice enough to send me a copy. So yeah, the book that I just published is called Talking About Trauma and Change. And it comes from me really doing work directly with those in services and training them about trauma. And so in today's episode, Kurt and I are going to talk about some experiences that we've had and how you can consider taking the information you're learning from this podcast and other sources. And how do we educate, when I was in college, we called this psychoeducational groups, but how do you help people going into services, students in schools, understand the impact of trauma on their own neurobiology and well-being? And some insights that we've had through our work. But as always, bright, shiny objects of the week. So, Kurt, what are you thinking about this week?
Well, certainly, I want to start out by saying congratulations to you on obviously a bright, shiny object, not just of a week, but of a long, many weeks.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
In many ways, Matt, I look up to you, and I like watching what you do, and you do lots of things that I aspire to do maybe one day. And writing books is something that it's like a process. I don't understand how you would do it. So it's kind of like writing a song, right? I wouldn't even know where to start. Where people who are songwriters, they know how to do it.
Yep.
So I love being able to be engaged with somebody like you who's doing these things that I'm not doing, and I get to learn and watch. And so congratulations to you, and what an incredible accomplishment to now have two out there. And it's really, really cool.
Well, thank you so much, my friends. Those words mean a lot. And so, but besides the book, the one thing, I actually have a prop for those that have on video today, but I have a weighted, and it's like a weightlifting thing, a weighted blanket. I got this sucker for my birthday back in November from my wife. And we've talked about a little bit at the show, and I know Kurt and I, we kind of share this experience, is one of the things that really helped, I think, my thinking around trauma, emotional regulation, just a lot of things, was occupational therapy, especially working with highly autistic children, kids in special education. I just saw weighted vest, weighted blankets, things where they can kind of move around. My wife does this with her first graders as well. But these little platforms that aren't steady when you sit down, so you're kind of always moving. And I really got into sensory work with that, the occupational therapist that I've worked with. And I'm a guy who always loves to sleep under like all the blankets, but I'm also like married to a woman who like, she radiates like 300 degree heat at night. So I'm always like, just have a sheet on. And so I've got this 60-pound blanket now, and it has really, really helped. And so I think just as a bright, shiny object for me, it was cool that they're not cheap, and I'm really freakishly tall. So I couldn't buy it. It had to be a gift because I was too cheap to buy it on my own. But it was such a wonderful gift, and I'm sleeping really well. And I just like, it's kind of funny. My wife calls it my blankie now because I took it on a trip with me once. And, you know, on those cold days we sometimes get here in Colorado, I just love to, if I'm watching the game or something or a Netflix, just to curl up on the couch with the 60-pound blanket. So My dogs don't seem to like it as much as I do, but so yeah, that's my bright, shiny object of the week. And just a shout out to all the occupational therapists out there. You hold a, I hold you in very high regard. So, so our topic for this week, I'm just going to give you a little bit of a background. I'm not here obviously to sell a book, though. If you want one, you can buy one on Amazon.
I won't turn you down.
Yeah, I know. I won't turn you down. Amazon's open. And so, you know, part of this journey to, and this, you know, the subtitle of this is Connecting Paradigms Supplement, which was the book I put out earlier this year. And one of the things that I realized as I was writing Connecting Paradigms, the original book, and that's all about how we talk to clients, students about change that have trauma in their history, is that all of a sudden I have all these analogies that I love. The cup analogy, I use something sometimes, the hero's journey. I have all these things that I've really come to. They're kind of like my kids, I joke about, because I have to decide which ones to bring to trainings with me. And they just, when I tried to put them in the original book, it just sort of lost the focus of the book. The book is a real skill-based book, and all these analogies, the feedback I was getting from some of my first editors, was it just kind of slowed things down. And when you talk about neurobiology and change and trauma and mindfulness, there are already so many concepts that I started to cut these out. And after I got the first book published and you know, had joy for months about just saying I published a book, I just realized I had all this stuff on the cutting room floor that I thought could be really useful for folks. And because they've been useful for me over the years. And about this time, too, I've had this experience several times over the last few years. I've been asked to do trainings, more or less, for people in services, usually residential housing programs or substance abuse mental health programs, mostly with adults, but teens as well, that aren't already in higher level services. And the first time I did this, I was nervous, and I don't usually get nervous. And a friend, a therapist of mine who's working in a residential treatment center said, "Hey, Matt, just come in." And I'll never forget her words, because I knew exactly what she meant. She's like, "Just bring Matt." I'm like, "You don't want therapist Matt?" No, she says, "Bring the Matt that you bring to other trainings." And so I PowerPointed it up. I tucked in my shirt. I ironed. I did everything that I normally do. And about, you know, as a presenter who presents in front of thousands of people a year, you kind of feel things change in your audience at times. I just felt about halfway through this like 80-minute initial presentation is something's going on here. But I didn't quite get it through the interactions. But after the training, I had about a dozen people come up to me, again, who were struggling with addiction and a lot of other issues surrounding that, and said, "You know, now that I understand the impact of trauma on my brain, I realized for the first time in my life, I'm not a bad person." And I'm like, and as a therapist, I try to kind of think out how many therapy sessions I often had to have before I could have somebody get that realization. And boy, if I could get that in like 80 minutes by doing a psychoeducation, that's pretty powerful. And so I've been playing around with these ideas about how we communicate all this knowledge that we talk about on this podcast and this coming out to the folks that are actually in services. And is there a real, in some ways, liberating or beneficial impact to doing so? And Kurt, I want to throw it over to you as well, and just get some any kind of, you know, thoughts that you might have or experiences you might have about teaching people about their neurobiology and how that might give them insight to their emotions and behaviors.
Yeah, I'll kind of go a little bit back to you mentioning an occupational therapy.
Yeah.
Typically, you know, sensory integration is one.
Yeah.
And talk a little bit about kind of what I think, how I think of what my mission is and what I'm passionate about. Yeah. A lot of what I'm passionate about as a board certified behavior analyst is getting behavior analysis into these other areas that aren't typically you would get behavior analysis into. And I love having interaction and integration between disciplines. I think it's so important. So when you mentioned sensory integration, I thought of this wonderful occupational therapist that I've worked with over the years, and where we had some really great discussions about sensory integration and sensory diets. And one of the cool things that we were able to integrate was to be able to find out if we did a sensory intervention, was it actually a regulating event or was it an activating event?
Mm.
And so it was really cool. We used heart rate.
Yeah.
So we just, we would do the event and measure heart rate before and after and find out what happened. And so tying those things together from the measurement standpoint, which is kind of my behavioral world, and this really cool intervention that her argument was actually, she's a very, very systematic thinking kind of person. So that was really fun for me. And as we did that, right, what we were really thinking was from a trauma-informed perspective, which is what you're, what we're kind of your question you're asking is, if we learn about the inner workings of the body, and then we find that the things that happen inside the skin follow physical laws, and they follow, they're just like physical events that happen outside the skin, and we can understand them. We have technology now that gives us the ability to observe them and to measure them.
Yeah.
Gives them into this domain of natural science, which is really, really cool. And that, to me, is one of the really fun things to do. And as you learn about that, the cool thing I think that it happens is you get two effects. One is that it gives you a framework for understanding what might be happening with that other person in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
When you gives them an additional lens to view their behavior through. And that's really, really cool. And the other thing that it gives you is the ability to understand what's happening to you.
Yeah.
So when you think about what's going on in your brainstem and in your limbic system, and as that information gets to your frontal cortex, and you're trying to make sense of what's going on at lower areas of your brain, it gives you the ability to pause and think before you act.
Yes.
Critical skill, right?
Like absolutely.
Critical skill in every environment.
For all of us.
Yes. Whether you're in a board meeting, whether you are in front of a child in a classroom, whether you're a child in a classroom facing a math problem, the ability to pause and think and check in with your internal state before you take the next action is a critical skill to being effective in this world. And that's why we have a frontal cortex.
Yes.
So for me, those aha moments are so fun to produce and so fun to have.
Yeah.
As a person, that's kind of the fun draw for me a lot of doing training on trauma-informed care, using the concepts from it, producing that kind of interaction with somebody. Super fun.
A good question for you. When you did, I know you've done some really cool stuff with heart monitors in different settings. Did you relay, and if you did, how did you see the effects of it, relay the data that you were getting to the people wearing the heart monitors? I think you were working, I knew you were doing this, I think, with kids and teenagers. Just kind of how did you use that data to help folks gain insight on their own sort of emotions and behaviors?
Absolutely. What we did is we thought of it, be notorious for giving a long answer to a short question. But we'll kind of go back a little bit, right? And here's some of this blend of what's a typically thought of as a behavioral approach, where we're talking about what somebody does, and what's an inside the skin approach, which we think is a non-behavioral approach. And I think the lines between those two are getting blurrier, more and more blurry as we get more information. What we thought was one of the reasons why behavioral interventions are considered so effective is that it takes a phenomena that everybody has access to so that we can all talk about, right? Part of it is defining behavior so that we can measure it. So that when everybody sees it, they know what they have, the same concept of what that behavior is, right? So if we're treating self-injury, we write down, what does self-injury look like? And we define it out in terms of the physical actions. And when it comes to inside the skin, that's more difficult because only one person has access to that.
Right.
And so what we did is we took, we've used both pulse oximeters to be able, if somebody didn't want to wear a heart rate strap, we've used the wrist monitors.
Okay.
And we've used heart rate straps.
Yeah.
And basically what it does is that if the person is either looking at a number on a pulse ox or they're looking at a number on a wrist unit, then it takes an inside the skin event and brings it outside the skin. So everybody has access to it now. It's a number.
Yes.
So then we can tie that to the arousal continuum very quickly. Right? We can tie it to you know, we'll take a baseline measure and go, oh, we are at 100, you live at 120.
Yeah.
Some of my favorite stories are having a teenager, specifically I'm remembering a young teenage girl who was sitting in my office with her clinician. I was the clinical director at the time, and I was teaching this clinician kind of how to do this. And we're having a calm, collected, really cool conversation. And I'm asking her a few questions. She's sitting relaxed in a chair, big fluffy chair in my office. And I said to her after about 3 minutes of the conversation, I said, I just want to pause real quickly. And I want to check in with your internal state. Could you look at your wristwatch and tell me what your heart rate, what the number is? 127. Just sitting there, right? So then we thought that was a way to start talking then about the difference between state and trait.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, so you now have a trait where you live at 127. If I'm at 127, I'm jogging.
Exactly. Yes.
Well, I'm really scared. Like, so I'm alert. I'm like, I'm scanning the environment for danger, and I'm driven to bring that down. And she lived there. So she was scanning the environment for danger all the time.
Yeah.
And she was actually exhibiting a lot of dissociative symptoms where she was not organized by danger cues enough, right? She wasn't paying attention, organized by environmental events, which is a definition of dissociation. And so she was driven when her heart rate came down, she was driven to get it back up.
Yeah.
To get back to her homeostasis, to get back to that trait. And so that was where you get all these symptoms described as people causing crisis.
Yeah.
But it's really a drive to get your heart rate back up to where you are. And you have to, like, you have to take action to do that.
Yes.
And so you get driven.
Yes.
Does that kind of answer the question?
Absolutely. And I just think, I mean, the fact that we're starting to get the technology and, you know, Kurt, I know we've done some amazing work on this, to get that sort of immediate feedback from folks and use that as a teaching tool to help them understand some of their behaviors as well, because that's what, you know, I think what I've seen really, some of the power of analogy, just from a guy who does a lot of teaching right now, again, across a lot of different spectrums, is analogies and stories hit people in a different way. And that's where, you know, as I've had the opportunity to really train, you know, folks in services, you know, I had this experience too in with the Cleveland School District. I've been working with them for several years. And they have, the program I work with, one of their things is they work with, families experiencing homelessness. So they work with the family and the kid. And, you know, I ran this, training. It was basically for the parents that had to come in, and they didn't have to come in, but I love this carrot that they stuck out there. So imagine that you're a parent of a young elementary school kid, and the kid comes home with a flyer that says, if you go hear Mad Talk for 90 minutes, you and your kid can go see LeBron James and the Cavs the next weekend for a Christmas dinner. So while they did have to come, can you imagine your kid saying, I don't want to go to this because, you know, I know we're going to miss LeBron.
Right.
But
right.
So it was kind of a captive audience. But, you know, it was, you know, while we weren't using the heart rate monitor, you know, talking to them about their neurobiology. And one of the things I really realized through all my experiences is folks living this get this. You know, I bet the young lady, could understand that state and that feeling in some way, and putting a number by it can be a really powerful thing. And so I was talking to these parents. They're mostly, there were a few men in the room, but it was a pretty large room. And you know, it just like, I went into the brain, talked about the amygdala, you know, kind of my 15-minute sweep by the brain, and gave some analogies to help them understand the role of stress and emotions and behaviors. And there was this group of about a dozen ladies up there, and I was kind of talking to one people, and these ladies were kind of gathered in a group. And when I walked up to them, you know, I was kind of at the end that they were all kind of sharing, you know, they were all kind of comparing A scores in some ways, and they were all like really high. And they all realized that they had all been sexually assaulted or molested before the age of 10. And that's what this group shared. And, you know, over and over, it's like, you know, I've just never understood myself. And I had no idea how to understand my kid, even though I saw a lot of the same behaviors. I had no idea. And it's like, you know, the other piece of feedback that I was like, okay, we got to figure this out, was I understand why my case manager or my the worker I'm working with, the counselor, keeps suggesting mental health therapy. It's like I never really understood why this, how this might benefit, but really, you know, understanding the biological damage that experienced and how that manifested in its own life, you know, just created that understanding for some of them for the first time. And I followed up with the program and they actually registered several people afterwards, more than they usually do. And so just to kind of see that, okay, you know, it's like, it's not just kind of that message that there's something just wrong with me. And if I just wanted to do something different, I could, that there's a biological injury there that needs healed. And I thought, you know, between, you know, I realize that I'm not a bad person and I understand why I need mental health therapy, how a little bit, because I, like I said, I don't have 8 days with these people. I had 90 minutes with one, you know, a little longer with the other group, but it was just amazing to see the level of insight with just a little bit of knowledge on the brain and their biology. And I thought that was fascinating to see such great returns on a short investment.
Yeah, I've certainly seen that as well, and have heard people talk a lot about how it's a different approach to take instead of talking about things that are unpleasant to talk about. And really, we're kind of shifting the focus from what's wrong with you to what happened to you.
Absolutely.
And that's a big shift. And then as we talk about what are the underlying mechanisms behind your, what drives you.
Yeah.
Like to seek out, and those drives like are what will function in behavioral words, right? Would be what will function as a reinforcer for your behavior.
Yes.
And they tie those two things together, and we understand that some of the fun ones are for children, of course. Some of the competing ideas between traditionally behavioral approaches and a trauma-informed approach is what do you do in the crisis moment?
Yeah.
Right. And this is a lot of Dan Siegel's work, right? Where he says, you're not going to spoil a child by giving them more attention.
Absolutely, yeah.
If they probably need co-regulation during the crisis.
Yeah.
And then a lot of the trauma folks will say, well, yes, we need structure. And they're right, right? They'll be like, and yes, we need structure. We need programs. And like,
yes.
That's ABA. Like, that's what we do, right? Like, we have reward programs. We have positive behavior support systems, right? Do them all day long.
Yes.
And then do this other thing as well. So it's not like, the ideas of and you know, talking to Jerry, right? He says this a lot, right? If you have to throw away everything that you were doing.
Yeah.
Add to your understanding of it. And
absolutely.
And that's kind of, I think, the process that happens is when we start talking about a way to understand some of these drives and a way to understand that what is functioning as a motivator for you, it doesn't mean that you're crazy.
Yeah.
It means that you've gone through things that produce those drives.
Absolutely.
Like even understanding them doesn't necessarily make them go away, but it helps you put them into context.
Exactly. And the other piece of the sort of the equation that I also find interesting, and even though the first book I wrote, talk especially using motivational interviewing, which is a real language for helping folks consider and make changes, is, you know, I think a lot of folks just that I found just don't understand why it's so hard to make big changes in their life. Why it's so hard to, you know, and I don't think our society as a whole doesn't have this information readily available that, you know, in some ways changing habits that you've had for years means changing the physical structure of your brain. And that, you know, when I talk to folks that are struggling, especially with addiction, because boy, you don't get anybody that beats themselves up more than somebody who's struggled the horrors of addiction a lot of times, you know, just that little bit, okay, so my brain gets hardwired around this behavior, and then my brain, it becomes very predictive, and I'm really good at doing what I did yesterday and the day before, and then, you know, I talked to a little bit about how then you throw opiates or dopamine or whatever the drug does in there, and it's like, yeah, somebody bites their teeth. This is like you bite your teeth and you feel awesome, or at least you feel awesome at first, but you're at least relieving pain. It's looking at it as a coping skill that's logical before it became harmful as an addiction. And, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh, maybe I'm not as effed up as, you know, I've sort of thought and people have told me throughout kind of my life, obviously not in services, but, you know, they get that message so much. And it's just like, how can we do a better job of, if the brain has changed our thinking, how do we package that? And I'm even thinking, like, how do we teach first graders a little bit about their neurobiology, whether it's stress, trauma, emotions, change behavior? And boy, if we became brain literate, how would that change our perceptions of ourselves? Because I'm sure that all this work that you've done, I look at myself differently at times, all the time, really, at this point. But yeah, but yeah, I just kind of wonder, and the question to you is, what do you think brain literacy for kids and then into adults and families, how do you see that as a potential game changer?
Yeah, go back to an experience I had as an undergraduate at Utah State. They have a school on site, like most universities do, right? Yeah. They have a school. They have a teacher training program, school psych program. So they have a school, and I think it's considered an experimental school, something like that, right?
Yeah.
But one of my professors who taught me behavior analysis, basically, one of the things he did is for a third grade classroom, he and one of his doctoral students created a curriculum for understanding behavior. Mm-hmm. And they taught third graders how to understand behavior.
Awesome.
And it made a big difference in their behavior, both in the classroom and at home.
Yeah.
I mean, one way to even understand that is that it created shared language between the child and the parent or the teacher who's managing their behavior.
Yeah.
And so they got to think about understanding their own behavior and understanding another child's behavior in the classroom. And I think the same thing happens with being brain literate.
Yeah.
As we get more people involved in understanding, I mean, one of the great things I've heard kids say over the years is you teach them the structure of their brain and what, like, that the amygdala is functioning to make it, you know, their impulse and their emotions be activated, right? Like, their amygdala is on fire today.
Yes.
They're ready to move into cognitive intervention when they say, it wasn't my fault, it was my amygdala.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, all right, okay, we're good on regulation and the education piece. Now let's go into some more cognitive intervention.
Exactly. But what I like, I think what the words you just said, like, for them, and I teach, you know, different analogies that are, you know, the cup analogy is one that I've taught, and we'll talk more about that in coming weeks, but I present that in the book too. But, you know, to say, I kind of think about it, and you may appreciate this as a behavioralist, of, in my programs, especially before I got this knowledge, but I still think this is kind of the paradigm we operate under, is when you, like, I've got a kid that's angry, right? Pissed off. Something happened. I don't know what happened. And what would be my programmatic expectations of this kid? A kid, let's just say with trauma, some mental health issues. Let's just say they're sitting in a school classroom and they blow up. You know, really my program's designed because I want the kid to respond this way. You know, teacher, I'm getting a little stressed out right now. And I think if my cortisol is pulsing through my brains, and if I think my first coping skill should be take some mindful deep breaths, and if that doesn't work, maybe go out in the hallway to change my environment and really focus on my long-term goals and how my current behavior is going to impact my long-term goals. And if I'm still angry, maybe I can take a run or two around the building to replace some of that cortisol with some endorphins so I can really come back into class and engage in this important lesson you're teaching. Like, you know, it sounds...
What adult can do that?
I know, exactly. But I set programs up, like, and, you know, behavioral supports, if you look at them, you know, my question to all of our listeners is, what are you really asking your folks to do? And where I found with this, the psychoeducation on the brain behaviors is, if I can say my amygdala's alarming, or the cup analogy, my cup's filling up.
Yeah.
I think that there is an ability for folks, again, with histories of trauma, which can have some language development issues as well. I may be able to use an analogy or a body part where I can't say, right now would be some really, a really good opportunity for me to practice mindfulness as a way to de-escalate my own emotions. And I just think if we can give folks the language, and like you said, that shared language, you know, what greater gift can we give folks?
And
I would hope eventually, if when they said, you know, my cup's filled up, then we train the staff to say, okay, I'm not going to logically engage this individual at time. I need to give the person some space let them cool off. So there are real realistic interventions when they can verbalize even just, you know, the analogy of it to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a couple of fun stories about those you brought to my mind that have become stories I've used for now a couple of years at least. And one is when we started using heart rate monitors.
Yeah.
We started to have the people who are wearing the monitors. This was in a residential setting.
Yeah.
School setting. What we started to do is to use the positive behavior support reward system as a motivator for checking in with your internal state and asking, communicating what your number was to a teacher or to a paraprofessional or a direct care staff on the unit, and then making a decision, a collaborative decision about what to do next, given that number.
Yeah.
So, and we're saying, like, we're just going to give you your points that you can trade in for later, right? As a we'd use the motivator to get the relational intervention to happen.
Great.
And the regulating event to happen.
Yeah.
Right. So it was kind of fun to be able to say that and be like, listen, we're just going to give you what you want and we're going to give you points for it.
Yeah.
So it was shifting the interventions. I called it shifting it developmentally.
Yeah.
Where we were giving it, using a motivational intervention to what was a motivational problem.
Yeah.
But if we're asking a child in the classroom to do something that they aren't developmentally ready to do, then it's not a motivational problem.
That is
great. So applying a motivational intervention isn't really going to work.
Right. Exactly.
So we shifted the motivational intervention to where it was within their repertoire of skills that they could do and what they needed.
Yeah.
And then the motivational intervention matched up with the motivational problem nature of what was needed to happen. And then it works.
Yeah.
So we would have lots of that happening. I mean, some fun ones that we've done, really fun in classrooms. We looked at, here's a functional behavior assessment one. We didn't even have heart rate at this point.
Yeah.
But works great. What we saw is we just did a functional behavior assessment and found out that at least the probabilities were that what was motivating a child's elopement and aggression symptoms in a classroom was that it was escape. Mm. I was getting out of the classroom or getting away from an unpleasant task. That's what kind of generated it. And so what we, and this was a young man with autism.
Yeah.
And so one of the things with autism is being very, very rule governed.
Yeah.
And so this child was actually pushing himself so hard that he would become overwhelmed with the task when he couldn't do it. And then having the thought or the idea of I'm going to fail.
Yeah.
It was so difficult, it generated a big stress response. We get a big explosion. We get tearing up a classroom, throwing over desks, or running out in the hallway, right? Ending up in probably a restraint.
Okay? Yeah.
And or somebody getting hit. And so what we did is we said, we need to find out about how often this happens. And then we're going to basically divide the day into intervals based on an average of occurrence per day. Mm. And we're going to give you your positive behavior support rewards for taking a break before you get to that point.
Great.
All right. So it's just, we're going to give you your points for doing what you want.
Yeah.
Right? It was applying the motivational intervention to a motivational problem.
Yeah.
And I mean, the rapid decline, I know tons of people can tell stories like that.
Yeah.
That it just worked really, really, really well when we can get that kind of shared language about what's happening.
Absolutely. And you know, I talked to, you know, one of my hopes for the future of education, because I hear this so often with those that I do when I train at schools, but it's, you know, to have that flexibility, it's a challenge. It takes a really sort of, as I like to say, a healthy system with enough capacity not to rely on the rigid structures that we've traditionally used. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to hit sometimes. It's like, you know, occasionally, this is the exception and by far not the rule, but I'll have usually somebody in administration. Teachers get this, but they're just worried that, you know, I've got a classroom of 25 and I've got four of these kids. How do I help regulate all those while teaching the other? And I was like, we need to advocate for more resources in the classroom is my answer to that. Cause I don't have a perfect answer to that, but it's like, a lot of times I've seen this in residential care as well. It's like, we're so ingrained with these old ways of thinking. So even though when we got proof that the science doesn't support the old ways like I did, because they don't have the biological ability or the developmental ability yet to really express themselves in the way we sort of want. It's a real challenge to us to say, how can we be more flexible? And that may mean that one kid in class gets away with something another kid doesn't get away with. And I think that's really hard for us to sort of handle. It's like,
the questions know, are our notions of justice and fairness.
Exactly. I mean, but that's a hard thing. And that's why we just, I think the thinking in our higher cognitive self needs to come out of saying, okay, let's have this discussion of what this means and how you communicate that to other second graders, that you're going to treat Matt different than Kurt, because Matt's going through some stuff and Matt needs a little different intervention than Kurt does. And that, I mean, nothing about this doesn't challenge us in some way, shape or form, but.
Yeah, certainly some of the things that, but your question is a great one, right? What do you do when you have a classroom of even 12?
Yeah.
Right. Yes. And you've got all 12 of them.
Yeah.
They have a lot of need.
Yes.
And so how you structure the day
in
an environment that is really, really important. And a couple of quick, the little kind of rules that I've learned over the years and applied with a lot of fun success is dividing out even each hour into doing something regulatory, doing something relational, and doing something cognitive. But you can do all of those things.
Yeah. And
I've done this with picture schedules for kids on the autism spectrum. We've done it with words for kids who don't need pictures. And actually just generating a schedule where it's like, I need to do something regulatory. So on my, like I talk about even very, very severely affected people with autism spectrum disorder. We use picture schedules a lot with that. Where
yes, absolutely.
Trade it from one side of a card to another side. But having a little picture of, I need to go push on a wall. And one kid loved to do that, right? We called it, I need to hold up the wall.
Yeah.
And he'd go over and then engage large muscle groups. That was a regulatory event for this young man. Doing something relational where for him, I'll go with this one kid. We basically gave him 100 compliments. And he could go pick which person in the classroom he needed to go give a compliment to and scroll through his list of 100 and learn how to go over and engage with somebody socially by saying something nice.
Yeah.
Or by going over and asking a question about something somebody was interested in. So things that would then kind of trap the social interaction, and like people love to talk to you when you want to listen to them.
People
love to talk to you when you say something nice at the beginning of the conversation. So, and then something cognitive, right? So we would do math, or we would do reading. So we would tie in the academics in there because it was a classroom.
Yep.
Right. So that was to speak to the education side and the goals of a classroom, which is to do academic intervention.
We need
to get to that, sometimes during the day.
Yeah.
So those are things I think that are things to kind of think about when we look at classroom design and environment design. Positive repetitive events that are targeted developmentally, and we put them into the structure and schedule them out.
Yeah.
Those can be really, they're super effective.
Yeah. And you know, as you were talking about that too, I think in some ways it's easier maybe for us to think about children with those sort of interventions, but man, the adults, I had a great day yesterday at the Aurora Day Resource Center. A new day shelter for those experiencing homelessness. And it was like, it really cool because I went out and trained them on trauma before they opened their doors. Now they're 6 months in and walking in, they got this gym that they've created, this beautiful space with showers and laundry and, you know, allowing people to be human beings and spend the day with people who care and welcome them in. And again, I think about what a lot of those folks need that have years of, you know, have never had a chance to recover and heal from their trauma, have ACE, you know, don't forget about ACE scores at this point because all the trauma with homelessness and addiction as well. And really, you know, we're working with that group of how do we set our expectations and our interventions at their, where they're at developmentally as well. Granted, they're not developing, you know, as far as children and child development, concerned, but a lot of them, due to their addiction and trauma, that their neurobiology is back in earlier levels. They may have not developed much outside their teenage years. And, you know, how do we help them? How do we create environments where they can thrive too? And those interventions look a lot different, like we said, than just talking somebody sort of down in de-escalation. And so being that creative piece, I think is really, really critical.
Yeah.
And then the other thing too, that I'm sort of interested in getting your thoughts on, and because it was a big reason why I wrote the follow-up book, was, you know, how does, if you think about somebody that has that complex trauma, that has the high adverse childhood experience scores, that they're struggling with all this, you know, what role does self-understanding, it's sort of that know thyself, was that the Parthenon, some ancient structure had that outside, I think it was Greek in some way.
I think you're quoting the Bible now, Matt.
I don't know, it was on the Matrix, so that's all, you know, it was on the Oracle's doorway, so there's your history from Matt. But I just kind of wonder what self-insight is so critical, and from the behavioral perspective, I'd be interested in this, like, you know, the more I understand me, the more I understand my behaviors, the more I understand what's a biological injury and maybe things that I can eventually start to gain some control over. And just kind of wondered, what's some of your thoughts about understanding and the healing process?
Yeah, I think often I go to the, we talked about a slide image with different events that affect the reward centers of the brain. And there are lots of those events, right? I think we did this on the 5 R's episode, maybe 3 episodes ago, right? So there are some of the easy ones, alcohol, obviously, right? Drugs of abuse, they all activate reward centers in the brain, which is why they become addictive. We get the same kind of dopamine rush when we check our phones.
Yeah.
So we get social interaction that way. Changes in physiological state can also activate that. So getting excited can be, like, activate the reward center. Becoming calm can activate the reward center. And one of the really interesting ones that is on that slide, and this is fun in the literature, is behaving consistent with an internal set of rules activates a reward center in the brain. And that's really cool, right? So and in the behavioral language, we talk about 2 big categories of behavior. There's probably more than that, right? Like, as they say,
I can probably remember too.
All models are wrong, some are useful. So far, this has been useful, at least to me. So one of them is what we call contingency-shaped behavior. And so when I go stick my finger in a light socket, I just found out what happens, right? I contacted a contingency between my behavior and an environmental event. So I'm not likely to go do that again because it hurt. Now, if you tell me, I've never seen a light socket before, and you point over there and go, hey, let me give you a little tip. Don't ever stick your finger in that, because if you do, it's really going to hurt.
Yes.
You've just given me a rule.
Yep.
And if I never stick my finger in that light socket, what the thing that produced that change is very different.
Yeah.
Now you gave me a rule to follow, as opposed to me going and finding out what happened.
Yeah.
And as we understand ourselves, we start to generate more of these rules. Mm-hmm. Human beings, we all know we do this, right?
Yeah.
We generate rules for situations all the time. We verbalize them in our head. We talk to our friends about them. And when people violate our own rules, that's when we go, what were they thinking?
Yeah.
Right? So it's always that experience.
Yeah.
And human beings are so good at that.
Yeah.
It really makes us very, very effective, because we don't have to go find out that, like a dog, right? They experience the world through their nose.
Yes.
Right? So that's why a dog will go get a quill, go sniff a porcupine over and over again and get a face full of quills a lot.
Yes.
Because that's how they experience the world. We experience the world with our frontal cortex. We have an experience simulator.
Yeah.
And it makes us really, really effective, because we don't have to go try out all these dangerous things to find out that they're not a good idea. We can follow rules. We can imagine what would happen if we did that. And doing that, so when we understand ourselves and generate these rules about interacting with the world, and when we behave consistently with them, we feel good.
Yeah.
And that functions as a reinforcer.
Yeah, and that just really goes hand in hand. I was actually teaching this yesterday when I was training folks on motivational interviewing. Is one of the things that MI has really taught me, and I was reading this, and it goes along with the rules. It's the values we live our lives by, which is really, to me, those core central things that you know, if we express them and say them, they should guide our behavior. And one of the things I like about what MI's done is it talks about that cognitive dissonance, or that, you know, being uncomfortable with the status quo in your current situation, or being uncomfortable that you're not realizing there's unrealized potential out there that you're not realizing through your current behaviors. And so, but when they looked at what really causes this cognitive dissonance, it's when you recognize that your behavior is out of line with your values. Mm-hmm. And the more it's out of line and you realize that, the more it pulls you into motivation for change. And one of the things that I've had, I do this with professionals at times, and put it in a format, including the book, about how you help people in, you know, services. I think this can be probably as young as later elementary school. Talk about what are the rules they live their life by. Well, what are their values? There's some value sheets out there. And once you get those established, now you have a real baseline to help them, you know, kind of how's your behavior either helping you live your values or not helping you? What if changing behavior, how would that help you live a life better aligned with your values? And, you know, the joke is I wrote these down myself about 7 or 8 years ago. Now I was like, no, it just seemed like this, you know, touchy feely exercise to write down your values. And it's changed a ton in my life. Like, I'm not saying it's always good changes. There's some things that I miss, with some of the values I've had, but you know, I know I'm healthier when I live in line with my values, and I'm more fulfilled. And usually though, sometimes I have to give things up that I really love. At the same time, I feel better overall, and I'm usually living healthier when I do that. So, you know, I always encourage people to talk about, you know, have people, because our assessments sometimes can be so negative, what are the rules you live your life by? What do you value most in life? What would your friends say are the rules that guide your behavior? And it gives you such a deep understanding of people in that way. And so I would support that's an effective tool, talking about those rule pieces.
Reminding me of dialectical behavior therapy.
Yeah.
And one of the post measures of, I think this came out of Linehan's lab in Seattle, that after a suicide attempt, it obviously it didn't work if you're talking to the person afterwards, right? One of the things that is always at least a post attempt intervention is to do an assessment called the Reasons for Living Scale. Mm. And basically it says, what was the thought that kept you alive? And it was thinking about a loved one? Was it responsibility for children? I mean, there's several different questions. It's like you rate them and it starts to generate this idea of what do I value and what am I living for, and what's guiding my behavior, right? It's a pretty linear progression between all of those things when you think about, I mean, that is really questioning your own existence.
Yeah.
And what leads you, why do you exist, all the way into what guides my behavior in every single moment. So that connection, I think, is a really, really cool one.
Absolutely. I got one more question I'd love for us to tackle with the time left. And it's one that I obviously have an investment in, because it's basically the reason why I've got 2 books out now, which I'm still excited to say. But I'm really... all this in some ways, all of our conversation today, and in some ways really why we're doing the Trauma Informed Lens podcast, is that in some ways one of my goals is to help people become both trauma-informed but also brain literate. As I could probably find a better way than brain literate to describe it, but you know, if we agree, then I think we're in agreement. I know Jerry would agree with us. The better you understand yourself and your biology, it can lead to insight. I think it can help further along the healing process, because I think it's easier to, for some people at least, to overcome the shame associated with past trauma or the resulting events due to, you know, kind of the symptoms of trauma and the biology. Really realize this potential that lies there. I really believe that especially in the next 10 years, but I think it should be a pretty urgent thing on people's, you know, professional development lists and organizations, is getting staff, whether that's teachers, whether that's youth treatment counselors working on the floor, foster parents, administrators, brain literate. And I kind of want to get your thoughts on that as somebody who talks a lot about the brain, knowing that it's, again, I think still the most complex thing we've ever found in the universe. And I learned there was whole journals on like the hippocampus now. Like, think about that. One part of the brain has its own journal. Yeah. But I just kind of wonder, like, with all this information, and we do deep dive times into the real polyvagal theory, which you still have to explain at this point. But what do you think the level of the professional that working and having conversations, whether it's a teacher, a counselor, what do you think about brain literacy and how it can really help improve our services?
Yeah, I think two things come to mind. And one is, I'll go with the kind of the nuts and bolts one first. And that is that it's useful to the extent that it translates into different actions when we're in the environment, right? So that's kind of what I put a lot of my effort to. Jerry has kindly said that my superpower is I can operationalize almost anything. And so I can take all these concepts and go, so what do I do tomorrow?
Yes.
And so being able it's useful to that extent.
Yeah.
In some sense. In the other sense, I think that one of the really great things that could come out of it, not just tomorrow, but really into the future, is that it starts to generate a lot more creativity.
Yeah.
And a lot more things like, oh, if we did this, this would happen. Or if we did this, if we understood this, then this would happen.
Yeah.
And the more people that you can, the more brains essentially that you can engage in that, the more creativity that there is.
Yeah.
And so having, for me, that's the big kind of future benefit of education about the brain, education about neurobiology, is that it starts to inform what we can do creatively to help people in a long-term sense of it. And that's been one of the funnest and most rewarding things for me professionally. I think most of the stories I told today were things that came out of clinical supervision when I was teaching somebody else these things and they were like, oh, well, what if we did this? And I'm like, go. Do.
Yeah.
Have at it. I wouldn't have thought of that. Great.
Yes.
I'll support it all day long. How much money? Go. So those are kind of the thoughts that come to my head about what's the real value in it and what are our targets, right?
Is it
creativity and that should be a target? And is it what should I do tomorrow?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you know, I said it, you know, in more of a treatment center setting where you've got lots of different levels of staff. I've been kind of thinking about that because education, again, you've got the sort of, especially in elementary school, the teacher in the classroom, though that changes throughout, but trying to think about, you know, could you have some sort of meta level experts of, you know, and I think a lot of people coming out of graduate degrees in psychology and other things are getting a lot of this neurobiology now, but have people, I think there's a level of comfortability with this. And this, just so you, our listeners know, this took me years. I had a few books I just listened to. Oh, Daniel Siegel's Mindful Brain audio book. I had those four CDs. That's how long I've had this. I had CDs back at the time. And I just listened to those over and over again. So I learned how to pronounce amygdala. If you want to know where I started, it was sitting there like amygdala. Vagal was one of the, you know, and vagus nerve. If you pronounce that wrong, it's not good to do in front of a lot of people, which I was at first. So I had to just learn how to pronounce these parts. Then we haven't even gotten to these action potentials and dendrites and axons to really grab this understanding. So having a few people, whether it's in a school, I think treatment settings are a little easier for me to visualize. And then really asking the question of what level of brain literacy do we want to have throughout our system? And there be a basic level of that from everybody. And I love to train the accounting people on stuff like this. They find it fascinating. Like they understand the people they're working with better and their work. And so having that basic baseline, so we all have, as we talk about all the time, that shared language. And then sort of thinking about, okay, if we have these kind of meta experts who hopefully feel comfortable with training, really, whether it's developing curriculum in schools or doing psychoeducational groups in other settings, getting that language then to those that we're serving. So I envision like an elementary school curriculum from K or even pre-K on to fifth grade, and then obviously up through high school as well, building on that. But, you know, how can we teach that chunks? And that's where I think analogies, one of the analogies of the book is like an elephant and a rider, where the elephant's the emotional brain and the rider's an intellectual brain. And it's a really great way, I think, to have any level of, you know, you can be, you know, 5 or 6 and kind of get that if you train the right way. And so having this real, this neurodevelopment, again, having a level of literacy within the organization, kind of like with trauma, that understanding, I think the two go hand in hand really well. And then figuring out, okay, now we've got the shared language of staff, how do we then start to train the clients or students or patients that we're working with? And now we're all talking that same language. And, you know, I think there's some real inherent challenges there because, again, I every time I stand up and talk about the brain, it's like, man, has another study come out in Hippocampus Journal that I don't know about. But I think that there's some kind of higher, we know the amygdala is associated with emotion. And I think 25 years from now, there'll be volumes of books written on the amygdala, but it will still be sort of the fear-based fight or flight a piece of it. So, you know, asking ourselves what we need to understand, what level, and then really getting that out.
Well, that was the real genius, I think, of the neurosequential model and Bruce Perry's model, right? Is he wrote it into 6 principles.
Yeah.
And we needed to understand the principles and a little bit of the neurobiology that drives the principles, but you don't have to know everything.
Exactly.
In order for it to make some sense and be able to guide some action. So I thought that was the genius thing, right, about the neurosequential model is there are 6 principles, and if you teach those 6 principles, you got a pretty good shared language about how we can start to talk to each other. And then there will be people who will take the deep dives into understanding how all the connections work and getting all the updated information. But there is a baseline level of understanding based on some principles and some concepts.
Absolutely. And I think, again, it shows if we can tell this through stories and analogies, I just think it's so much more graspable for folks. One of the other cool things is if you see me train on trauma, I use Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey for a lot of this. And I think one of my big, most powerful experiences is, you know, I can make a really, and I think it's an easy justification to make, is that people that have especially survived, and most people that I train have survived incredibly complex trauma, that they are heroes. I mean, they've survived things that have many people don't survive. And so their struggles are part of that journey because they haven't gotten the help and the resources they need to fully recover from it. But, you know, to watch somebody, and this is, I think, the biggest takeaway of working with folks to understand trauma is taking somebody who just kind of maybe feels like a victim or doesn't feel like a worthy person or just is carrying around so much shame. And by giving them a model to look at trauma as not a state that's going to go on forever, but as part of an overall journey, and that if we accept the right resources and support and build trusting relationships, that our biology changes over time, and having them, you know, and I don't say right out the bat, I think you're all heroes. I want them to kind of get to that conclusion is, you know, even if they're on the early stages of the struggles of the hero's journey, to see, okay, you know, I can really, there's this opportunity, and I'm always honest, if you do the hard work to turn that pain and suffering into, you know, real strength and wisdom, that will make you a better parent, that will give you strength throughout the rest of your life. And I think as I don't know if I hit everybody like this, because probably the people that I don't hit don't come up and tell me how awesome the experience was in the training. But you know, to communicate to them that they're not victims, they're not bad, they're not addicts, they're not homeless, they're people on this journey. You know, I always joke is if somebody sent on $500,000 of grant funding, I would love to see the long-term outcomes of just that change in mindset for folks. And it's a change that, boy, I hope we can get to people earlier in their life. So, because some of the people I work with, even though I've worked with teenagers, might be in their 60s or 70s. And with somebody that age that I know and shares a history of complex childhood trauma says, for the first time in my life, I realize I'm not a bad person. It's like, you know, part of me is like, awesome. And the other part of me is like, man, I wish we could have gotten this to you, you know, 50 years earlier. But hey, you know, we start with where the science is. So that was just kind of one of the more powerful things is, you know, helping people understand this again through the science, because I think it shows the biological injury and it's not a kind of they're a bad person sort of mentality, but also showing that it's a real strength to gain resilience and wisdom as well. I think it's just a really cool thing that I'm excited to explore more and more, hopefully over the next couple of years. So the theory is you write a book on something, you get to talk about it more. So I'm hoping that's the case, at least in my life. So yeah. Any kind of final thoughts before we head out, Kurt?
No, I mean, certainly your point is well taken that the goal of gaining greater understanding is for healing and to facilitate healing.
And absolutely.
Being able to do that better and be able to do it for a wider group of people is really the ultimate goal.
Yeah.
And congratulations on book number 2. That's really
awesome. Thank you. Available on Amazon, talking about trauma and change. So thank you. And thank you guys for joining us today. As always, you can find show notes, videos. We're also going to, I've been thinking about our show notes a little bit too, Kurt. I think I'm going to, we usually use questions to kind of organize our conversation. So I'm going to start to post those up for discussion questions as well. So you can feel free. Yeah, you can feel free to comment to us, or I've gotten a lot of feedback from folks that their whole teams are listening to our podcast and then talking about it in their team meetings. So
great. I just got more nervous. That's great.
Yeah, I know. It's just kind of nerve-wracking, but you know, so this will help because sometimes we're not the most structured individuals, but I think we do a pretty good job. So we'll give you some of these questions as well for hopefully to guide your discussions too. So again, you can find all that at traumainformedlens, all one word, .org, as well as a lot of other resources. So Kurt, great talking with you today. And I just want to thank all of our listeners for joining us again. And we will see you next week. Take care.
Great. Thanks.